This is Joanna Schrader reporting live for AgWire.com, and I'm here at Commodity Classic 2010 with Robert Wright, who is with the Renewable Fuels Association. Robert, how are you?
Good, Joanna.
So, Robert, I know you have a lot going on here, but one thing in particular I wanted to talk to you about is where we're at with the E15 waiver request.
Well, I mean, obviously we thought we'd have something in winter. That was delayed somehow, despite federal law that required the decision. Did hear again that from EPA just this week that they're looking at a late summer decision. And, you know, probably the one thing that stands out the most is the decision will hinge around model year 2001 and newer vehicles. So what I'm hoping personally is that they found some more data to go back further with older vehicles. Obviously, that's pie in the sky probably. But the reality is they're no doubt got some testing that's in play on a private side and through Department of Energy and EPA. So perhaps there's more data. Everyone still seems to be very optimistic. Secretary Vilsack was on record this week, once again stressing the importance of it. And for the most part, we haven't really heard much negative out of EPA. So I think a decision, a positive one, will come, whether that will be an E12, an E15, what model years will be included. But we definitely are going to have a challenge once that decision comes on for various reasons.
Are we going to reach 36 million gallons if we don't have E15 or if we don't have higher blends?
Well, it definitely goes hand in hand. I mean, if you look at a blend wall that, in the best case scenario, is 14 billion gallons and you have an industry that has 13.6 billion capacity, you're going to be there a lot sooner than some are even giving credit for today. So, you know, your mid-level blends, this intermediate blend level, E15, you know, E15 is great, but it is still a Band-Aid for the real issue. And the sticking point's going to come very soon. And the problem that we've been facing for well over a decade is you simply cannot flip a light switch and for this infrastructure to be there. And so we're, you know, part of the BYO ethanol campaign that we're working on with American Coalition for Ethanol and just traditional efforts to expand the E85 presence. The flex fuel vehicles, to be honest, are ahead of us now. There's definitely a market for E85. It's getting out to the petroleum marketers, convincing them that that investment is worth it for the long term, and the renewable fuel standard definitely shows that. There's 22 billion gallons above the blend wall that need to find a home in the next 12 years.
Now, you touched a little bit on the flex fuel vehicles. Flex fuel vehicles can use anything between no ethanol up to E85. So why has the automotive industry still... Why are they still being resistant to producing flex fuel vehicles as you build the infrastructure when, in essence, if they approve E15, any flex fuel vehicle can use it with no problem?
Yeah, it's always been, a little bit of a controversy. We've always wanted more flex fuel vehicles because no matter what blend level we end up in the future, you make your choice based on economics, not what's available at the pump, necessarily. But to be honest and fair, there is an additional cost that the automakers have for making those vehicles flexible. It used to be 250, then we heard 150, and maybe even 100. But if you're a company like General Motors, who's gone bankrupt, $100 times a multi-million vehicles, it's an expense. And to be quite honest, sometimes they have a fair argument that we haven't seen the response that we wanted by us producing the flex fuel vehicles we have. Now, the foreign automakers have stood on the sidelines for the most part. Nissan's got a couple of vehicles. Honda and Toyota have been pretty well absent, although Toyota now has the Tundra. And, you know, of course, they got their own problems, too. I think that in time you're definitely going to see more push for the domestics and the foreign automakers to meet the obligation that General Motors and Chrysler and Ford all put out. And 50% of their production model year 2012 would be flex fuel. I think what you're going to see from Congress is a requirement that they meet that, and then a slow but steady ramp up from there on.
Okay.
And the beauty of the flex fuel vehicle, whether you're compared to most alternative fuels, is most alternative fuels are a fleet application, where we have the unique ability of, since we're a passenger vehicle or can be the light duty vehicle, then it can be also a consumer alternative.
From a consumer standpoint, what is it that consumers need to know that they still don't seem to really be understanding?
Well, you know, part of the idea nowadays is you can't look at tomorrow or even today. It's what's going on in a year, 2 years, or perhaps in your children's future. It's an investment now. You know, the economics have swung around once again, so E85 is very favorable. I think I paid 70 cents under unleaded this past weekend for E85, more than enough to cover any of the fuel efficiency loss. But some people do get caught up in that. And I think a lot of it is, lack of education and a lack of infrastructure. I mean, if you don't drive past an E85 station every day, you probably don't know all the details and all the benefits of it. I think for the most part, the anti-ethanol rhetoric has died for the most part, so I don't think that's what they're hearing anymore. But they might have heard it last year, and it still resonates a little bit. But I think in time, as hopefully this administration continues to support the advancement of ethanol from all feedstocks, the automakers continue to push flex fuel vehicles. You go buy a car and it's a domestic car, it's hard to find one that doesn't have a flex fuel badge on the back anymore. So whether they like it or not, it's starting to get more and more in their face, and they're going to learn more in years to come.
Now, I guess we are at Commodity Classic, which is one of the largest agricultural shows in the country, so it would be remiss if I didn't ask you, from a farmer perspective, how does E15 affect, you know, corn growers specifically in our country?
Well, it's no doubt that the expansion of the ethanol industry benefits the farmers. The ones that are here, obviously, are the sorghum and corn farmers that benefit the most. We have plants that are obviously use nothing but sorghum in the south, and you have corn-only plants or a combination of the two. So there's a lot of farmers here and producers that have definitely supplied ethanol plants or have seen the basis on their crops increase dramatically just because there's a new market and a void being created in certain areas. So they're no doubt have benefited. It's hard to find one that wouldn't support that or even give you a hug when you talk about it. But the reality is that expansion of that ahead of the expansion of the blend wall ahead of the RFS2 requirement will impact them at a sooner. We're no doubt have to get past E15. That's the federal law that we're dealing with today. The farmers know that ethanol is going to be here for them next week, next year, next decade, and hopefully several decades down the road.
Great. And Robert, for consumers, where can they go to get more information about E15 or just ethanol in general or even your BYO program?
Well, the best source for consumers is chooseethanol.com. Obviously, we're trying to make them have a good decision, and that's the one to send them to. If they want to know more about blender pumps and the mid-level blends, they should go to byoethanol.com.
Great. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Joanna.